So I spent the past 4 days in Idlewild, California, a tiny little town in the middle of the woods up on a mountain. And during that time, I didn't check Twitter, I didn't check Instagram, I didn't post anything, I barely looked at my email, I didn't research Tupac. I just kicked back and took hikes with the wife and read a book and relaxed. And I really think in this rush, rush, rush world, all of us need to think about doing that more often, to give your brain a break, to not always consume yourself with the latest political news, with the work you have to do, to just chill, to just relax, to just be. And as I sit here back at home, I feel oddly refreshed and ready to get back at it after the break I never knew I needed. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Marty Appel, the former New York Yankees public relations director and the author of a brand new book, his 25th, titled Pinstripes by the Tail, Half a Century in and Around Yankees Baseball. This is episode number 313. Let's sing some Yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Marty, I've actually wanted to have you on this podcast for many, many years. I've known you for a long time. Obviously, I've known your work for a long time. You've written 25 books, which is utterly ridiculous, including your new one, Pinstripes by the Tail, Half a Century in and Around Yankee Baseball. And I've been reading it the last few days. And there's something about the way you write that it kind of reminds me of when I was a kid and I would smell my grandma's cooking. And then years later, maybe I'm in some restaurant or someone's kitchen and I smell the cooking again. Like, your writing and your approach to writing is very nostalgic for me in a very warm and loving place. And I remember, I hate to date you, but I remember being a kid and one of the books I loved was Thurman Munson, an autobiography, which you wrote with Thurman Munson. And there's just something about your writing that's super warm and embracing and inviting. And I just love it. And I wonder, I'm being serious, is that a deliberate thing? As a writer, are you deliberately going for that?
What I'm going for is the conversational tone. I want to be telling the story orally to someone. That's what I'm thinking as I'm writing. So it's very verbal, the content of the words. On this particular book, I had a nostalgic pull also, because I so well remember when I was young, really enjoying on my parents' bookshelves books that had a lot of short anecdotes, like a page and a half, and then white space, plus a lot of photos. They were so enjoyable. I do them over and over and over again. And that's what I wanted to do with this book. It was sort of a call back to my youth. There used to be like the greatest Irish stories ever told, things like that.
Yeah.
And they'd be short and to the point, and I used to love them. So that's what I tried to do here.
It's very funny because I would say my average chapter is probably 9,000 words, 8,000 words. And sometimes, honestly, I look at my own writing and I think, nobody wants a 9,000 word chapter, because I really enjoy the break, picture, think a little bit, go get a cup of coffee, do whatever you have to do, come back and you're right there. And I feel like you've really mastered it.
Thank you. In what might have been my last book, by the way.
Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I'll be 75 this summer. I didn't think I had any more ideas left until my agent suggested a book of the stories that I like to tell. And I wanted to do one book that I could dedicate to my three young grandsons.
Right.
So I got that accomplished as well.
I didn't see this going that way, but let's talk about this a little bit. So I'm 51. You said you're turning 75. I definitely noticed a change in my writing habits as I've gotten older. Do you feel like it has gotten harder writing, or is there something that changes in writing as you have aged?
No, because I've been fortunate enough to have subjects that really interested me. It wasn't like an assignment, like, do this book, you're going to get a lot of money. And I hated every minute of it. Every one I've done, I've enjoyed and been able to throw myself into. So I'm a fast typist. I got that in seventh grade typing class. And I'm able to think to my fingers quickly, and that makes it a pleasure.
for people who may not know, and I knew this already, but I do find it fascinating. You have a super long history in baseball and a super long history tied to the Yankees in one way or another. You were their publicist for a long time, but you started in 1968 as Mickey Mantle's fan mail clerk, basically. How does one become Mickey Mantle's fan mail clerk?
It had to do with it being the late 60s. And when I got I was a major baseball fan, and I got the idea of writing to the Yankees looking for a summer job to do anything. So I sent that letter sort of open-ended, I'll do anything. On the day the letter arrived in Bob Fischel's office, he was the PR director. It was the only letter of its kind, because in the late 60s, baseball was definitely not cool. And people my age in college were not interested in baseball. They were gravitating towards football and basketball when they weren't gravitating towards anti-war peace demonstrations. So I was sort of alone in the field there without realizing it. I was the only one in my college that got a subscription to the Sporting News. That tells you something. So on this particular day that my letter arrived, Pete Sheehy, the Yankees clubhouse man, wheeled into Bob Fischel's office like 8 cartons of unanswered fan mail. And Bob was a good enough PR guy to know this is going to be a lot of unhappy fans if these aren't responded to. So here's my letter. Here's the 8 cartons. It was made in heaven. I got called in for an interview. I did the interview went well, and I got hired. So my first year doing it was 1968, which means that I'm the last man standing who worked in the Yankee front office in the original stadium when CBS owned the team and when Mickey Mantle was still playing. And I had the good sense to look around me and know that to a lot of people, everything that's going on each day here matters. People really care why this guy got uniform number 24 instead of number 25. And all of these little ancillary facts were registering in my brain that there was an audience for this. So I appreciated the history. And by the time I was 26 or 27 and had become the PR director of the team, I was like the team historian and the wise voice from the past who said, wait a minute, you can't do that, and here's why.
What is it like being a mail clerk for an iconic baseball player?
Well, it could have been nothing because all the letters were the same. Dear Mickey, you're my favorite player. Please send me an autographed baseball. They didn't have to go anywhere with those letters. I could have just sent them a facsimile Mickey Mantle photo with a printed autograph and off they went. But I knew my opportunity was there, so I always managed to save up a few letters that I had to go over with Mickey in person. So I'd march into the clubhouse with my 3 or 4 letters. He'd laugh because he knew it was all bogus and I was just looking for time with him. And out of his intuitiveness to see that grew a friendship. He was amused by me. He liked me. I liked him. And we stayed friends until he died.
There were many people your age who idolized Mickey Mantle, right? Who idolized Mickey Mantle. Mickey Mantle symbolized something to them. And you come along and you get this job and you're working for the Mickey Mantle. And then you want to just get time with Mickey Mantle. But I've definitely found as a sports writer, as I know you have, like anything, the more exposure you have to someone, the more human they become. And they lose a little bit of that luster because they can't possibly live up to the luster of a 15-year-old boy's head. Did Mantle lose luster to you as you got to know him?
He didn't lose luster. It changed because when you're up close and personal with somebody like that, you hear and see things that change your image of the guy. But I saw not only my own hero worship in him not being diminished, but I saw how he treated everybody and his teammates and everybody else in the clubhouse, the attendants, the trainers. He was a great man, which you would see manifest on the baseball field by the way he'd run the bases after a home run, intending to never show anybody up, head down, do it efficiently and quickly, and get off the field. We would get a new player on the team, and I would witness this, somebody up from the minor leagues or somebody from the National League, and Mick would walk over to their place in the clubhouse, and he'd extend his hand and just say, "Hi, I'm Mick. Good to have you here." And when you see that, you just go, "Oh, this guy gets it right. He really knows how to be a great teammate." And they knew it was Mickey Mantle, by the way.
Right. Of course. When you sort of watch him toward the end and he had that really gut-wrenching interview when he was dying about, you know, hey, kids, I'm not a hero. Don't look at me as a hero. How did you sort of feel as that was, as the end was coming?
Oh, I felt so sad. And today I still, there's two players I think of, like, how can they be dead? They were so alive. I think of Mickey and I think of Tom Seaver like that. How did Tom Seaver die? Impossible.
Yeah.
But I, all these years later, he died in 1995. And I think what a void that's been for the baby boomer generation, particularly in the Northeast, where Mickey was a godlike figure. How do we lose these people?
Speaking of godlike figures, there's my transition. You write a lot about Joe DiMaggio. And I remember reading the Richard Ben Kramer book years ago, The DiMaggio Hero's Life, and coming away thinking, don't really love this guy. And then reading your book and kind of thinking, I don't really love this guy. It seems very interesting to have been in your shoes, which was a young media relations guy, a young team employee, having to deal with this legend. And you sort of write about this guy who just sounds like a high maintenance pain in the ass. Is that too harsh?
No, that's probably accurate. And then I used to say to myself, well, he's Joe DiMaggio. There's no other Joe DiMaggio out there. Maybe he's entitled. He would never come to an event, particularly Old Timers Day, without getting pissed off about something. So it was sort of the expectation. And you knew Joe would arrive, you'd treat him royally, something would piss him off, and he'd say, never coming back again. And we dealt with that from time to time. The story I tell about Old Timers Day in the book is the year Mickey retired was 1969, and we had this great Mickey Mantle Day. And the enthusiasm for Mickey carried over to Old Timers Day about 7 weeks later, when he was introduced next to last at his first ever Old Timers Day. And then DiMaggio was introduced last. Now, the cheering for Mickey just was incredible because his fans were younger, more vocal, more emotional, perhaps, at the time. And it was, you know, the sentimentality of Mick's no longer playing. I can't believe it. So when we introduced Mickey, he got this, again, this fabulous ovation that just went on and on and on. And then finally, we pointed to Frank Messer and said, introduce Joe. So DiMaggio was introduced last, and Mickey's cheers drowned it all out. So the next day, back in the office, we say, you know what, let's try something next year. Let's do DiMaggio next to last and Mantle last, so they both get their full due, full appreciation. And we did. The result being that Joe said he would never return. He was so insulted by that. And I think you can see our reasoning, but he was nevertheless very insulted. And we had to jump through hoops to convince him it was our bad call and he'd forever be introduced last, always as the greatest living player. And he never missed another Old Timers Day except for 1 year he was in the hospital. But he lived, he lived a long life till 1999 and ate every Old Timers Day after that.
Was there ever a point that you reached in your career when someone like that would be whiny and complainy and you just want to be like, you know what, man, if you don't want to come, don't come?
I might have felt that way with Reggie Jackson, but I was no longer involved in Old Timers Day by the time Reggie was eligible. But Reggie was a difficult character and he sort of took it upon himself to be his own PR director. Which he knew the names of all the writers. He knew how the media worked. He knew about deadlines. He knew everything. He was very media savvy. And that made him annoying. So if Reggie had said, you know what, I'm not coming, I would have said, okay, take care.
Good luck. In your job, you were in a very interesting and strange position, which is you sort of want these guys to come off positively to the public because you're representing the franchise. And yet you're dealing with a lot of mercurial and pain in the ass figures. And I always thought Reggie Jackson was such an interesting case because I grew up where Reggie Jackson was the megastar in New York, the big smile, the Reggie bar, the curtain calls, the three home runs against the Dodgers, good looking guy, on and on and on. And then I become a sports writer and everyone tells me he's just an asshole and impossible to deal with. Is there somewhere in between with him or is he just an asshole and impossible to deal with?
Probably nothing in between. It depends on your level of personal involvement with him. So if the fans loved him and showered him with love and threw candy bars on the field in his honor, that was okay. I mean, it's nice that fans have hero worship moments, and Reggie certainly was a big star on the field. But as I casually point out whenever I'm writing about him, he never hit 30 home runs 2 years in a row, which is amazing to think about.
Yeah.
And he was great if national TV cameras were there that said NBC or ABC. But if it was a Wednesday afternoon getaway day and game against the Brewers, you didn't expect much out of Reggie.
Well, it's funny because one of my favorite books that you wrote was a biography of Thurman Munson. First of all, first you wrote the autobiography, which I read when I was a kid. And then later on, you wrote Munson, The Life and Death of the Yankee Captain, which came out in 2009, which is a fantastic book. And when I was reading that book, I often thought about the juxtaposition between Munson and Reggie, who obviously did not have the best relationship. Do you feel like players back then, including Thurman Munson, sort of needed to hide their level of contempt toward Reggie?
Yeah, if you're going to be a good teammate and play 162 games and go on to great postseason moments, you've got to, and you got to remind yourself, it's a team sport, we got to all get along. And believe me, when the season ends and guys are traded or released and their Yankee days are over, they aren't sending Christmas cards to each other. That all works in season, you know, that loyalty and that friendship. But it's not like you and me would have an ongoing relationship and always keep in touch.
Actually, it's so interesting you say that, and this is way out of order, but like, I'm pretty good friends with Sean Green, the former Dodger, and he lives out here. And I'm always like, who do you keep in touch with? He played 15 years in the major leagues. I'm basically names like three guys. And I'm always amazed. I don't know if you found this too. How little ball players stay in touch with each other once they're done playing baseball.
It's usually the wives who keep in touch, who send the Christmas cards or keep in touch with the other wife. But the ball players themselves, and maybe that's more normal if you're just a guy and you don't care about such things, but the guys themselves don't really keep in touch. I keep in touch with Bobby Richardson, who was my boyhood hero. And he and Tony Kubek are like the only guys from Casey Stengel teams still around. And I always ask Bobby, have you heard from Tony? Been in touch with Tony? No, it's been a while. So these guys were so identified together as roommates and friends and there for each other. But no, they don't keep in touch.
Wait, so you did a lot of old timers games, which I love. And I'm sure you saw the Mets old timers game from last year.
Fabulous.
You had a great story in the book about 1973 old timers day. And you wrote, in 1973, the legendary Satchel Paige was an invited guest. When we announced that Paige would be attending, I got a phone call from a gentleman who said he owned an original Kansas City Monarchs uniform and would I like to borrow it for the Paige appearance. Would I ever? I knew this one would be spectacular. So Satch wore it for the player introductions. It was an otherwise all Yankee event marking the 50th anniversary of Yankee Stadium. So he was the only one not in a Yankee uniform. Satch report, he took it home with him. He put it in his satchel, I suppose. The visiting clubhouse man, Mickey Rendine, gave me the bad news. I still remember that awful call I had to make to the generous fan about its disappearance. I still think about it today, more than half a century later. Do you actually still think about that call today?
When I hear the name Satchel Paige, that's where my mind goes immediately. That I let that guy down. He was so generous to lend us that uniform, and I felt personally responsible for it. So yeah, that's where my mind goes.
Some weird questions about this. Number one, you have this old timers game, 1973. I'm looking at the photo of it, page 10 of your book. It's all Yankees and Satchel Paige in a Kansas City Monarchs uniform. Why was Satchel Paige at Yankees old timer game in 1970? He never even played for the Yankees.
No, but we made a point of inviting new Hall of Famers to old timers day. He had been elected in 71, but we hadn't gotten him to an old timers day yet. So that was the first one he was available for, and we wanted to make sure that he wasn't overlooked. But I can only imagine that wearing a Monarchs uniform when everybody else was in a Yankees uniform made him feel so separated, which in fact was the coda of his life story. he was separated from the major leagues for what years he would have been maybe the best pitcher ever.
What is it like making that kind of phone call? You have to tell a guy literally, you know, that valued, probably worth whatever jersey that you gave us uniform. We lost it. It's gone.
Worse, it was before the era of voicemail. So I couldn't escape by just leaving a voicemail. I had to reach the guy. And yeah, it was not a pleasant call. And he wasn't particularly happy, but the call had to be made and we got the job done.
That's fantastic. You worked as the executive producer for WPIX for games throughout the 80s and 90s. And this may not mean a lot to a lot of people, but I was a New York kid. I grew up sitting in front of the TV watching Phil Rizzuto, Bill White, Frank Messer, all these guys, you know, call Yankee games. I remember hey, Jesse Barfield, this bud's for you every time someone hit a home run. It seems like working with Rizzuto, who comes up a lot in your book, obviously, was like herding kittens as far as keeping that guy on track, keeping him talking about baseball. There was always someone's birthday or someone with a new suit. Was that a great experience or a difficult experience?
It was a great experience, but it had its challenges. First of all, Rizzuto would have naturally been the color commentator. There would have been a Frank Messer as a play-by-play guy, and then you'd want Phil to jump in when he spotted something on the field worth commenting about. But in his case, his focus and his concentration so waned throughout the game that you had to have him do the play-by-play or he wouldn't be paying attention. So I learned that early on. My partner on these telecasts was the great John Moore, who was the director. And we would always talk about things that needed to be done. And Rizzuto, being the play-by-play announcer, seemed so against type, but it needed to be done. So his head stayed in the game. But even as play-by-play announcer, if somebody walked by in the back of the press box and he spotted them and he knew them, he'd get up and go over and say, "Johnny Pesky, how are you?" So the color man was left to improvise and do the play-by-play during those absences.
Wait, I'm actually kind of curious about this. So you know what you know. And I grew up, Phil Rizzuto was my voice. Like he really was. He was the voice that I knew the most. He was much more distinctive than the Mets announcers at the time. He was the voice of the New York Yankees. And I move out to Southern California and there's Vin Scully and there's Chick Hearn. And these guys are classic, legendary. Vin Scully is a classic voice. Chick Hearn is a classic voice. In my head, I put Phil Rizzuto with those guys. Is that insane?
No, because he's the voice of your childhood. He's the voice of your baseball fandom. And in each city, people probably have those same feelings for guys you and I have long forgotten. But the feelings are beautiful, actually. It's a wonderful thing. And my son's favorite player was Don Mattingly, as it was for a lot of kids in the 80s. So there was a Yankeeography done of Don Mattingly. And I sent it to my son, who now lives in Boston. And he played it, and he called me as soon as he finished listening to it. And he said, "Oh, that moved me so much. Donnie Baseball, Donnie Baseball." And hearing Phil Rizzuto call those games, he said, "That was the best part."
My last book was a Bo Jackson book. And there was a game when Bo Jackson hit three home runs off of Andy Hawkins, a Yankee game. Rizzuto's calling the game. First home run, you know, Bo Jackson, blah, 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 blah. It's going on and on. Second home run, going on and on. And the third home run, Bo Jackson hits it. And Phil Rizzuto just goes, "Oh, no." And that was it. That was his commentator. It's really good. You wrote later in your book, in the sixth inning of your book, page 151, Dave Kaplan, the founding director of the Yogi Berra Museum, visited Yogi Berra in his care facility with me during his final weeks there, as we had done with Rizzuto. Same place. Carmen Berra had already passed, and he was happy to have some familiar company. The facility had been too carefree at telling people who were visiting loved ones what room Yogi occupied. He was quite uncomfortable, of course, having strangers knock on his door. We had a really nice visit. I brought him a book of baseball art by the great Andy Jarenko, who had painted all the Hall of Famers. It must have weighed 15 pounds. We talked about how the stolen base had gone out of the game, and Yogi reflected on that knowingly, mentioning how even a big guy like Hank Bauer could really run. As we were departing, I heard what could have been the last Yogiism. A nurse came into the room, and Yogi said, "What time is 3 o'clock mass?" Obviously, they hadn't always started on time, and this was a perfect Yogiism for the moment. He didn't want to get there too early. He died just a week or two later. And it is interesting because you're mainly chronicling guys who are now either pretty old or pretty dead. I wonder what it's like for you, because this is sort of life and what we all go through at some point, where you come up, you have this great career, you chronicle these different people, you work with these different people, and then one by one, they start dying. And these heroes you had and these friends you had, and now you're writing about them. I don't know, emotionally, what is that sort of like?
It extends beyond the players, because media too, I was very good friends with all the media that would cover it. So I was 19 when I started with the Yankees. And like a lot of people starting out in the business world, I suppose, you're the youngest and the friendships you make are all older than you. So inevitably, if you live a healthy life, they're going to depart and you'll be the last one standing. Now, it's different if you join, Apple Computers, because there's a lot of people your age when you join. But in baseball, everybody was older than me, and I've lost so many friends who were from media, sports writers, broadcasters. And it's difficult because it makes you think, I should have spent more time befriending the younger ones as they came into the profession, because all my friends stayed friends and were older. So that goes through my mind a lot. Phil Pepe, Maury Allen, people like that were really close friends of mine, and they were the journalists of that generation, and I miss them terribly as much as I do the players.
Before we continue at Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my daughter, Casey, and her new $10 plastic figurine she bought at a toy store.
Ugh, Dad, you're being doll insensitive. His name is Sunny Angel, and he's not just a $10 plastic figurine. He's a $10 plastic figurine who...
Casey, this is so stupid.
Let me finish!
No, because I know you're going to do the thing where you say Sunny Angel is real and he's important and he has feelings and I'm supposed to pretend this plastic piece of shit matters.
No, you monster. What I wanted to say is Sunny Angel is real and important and has feelings. And he's also an enormous Edmonton Eskimos fan who spends most of his waking hours going to RoyalRetros.com to buy all his favorite throwback jerseys, hats, and t-shirts.
RoyalRetros.com has clothing that fits little Sunny Angel?
Yes, but it's too late to make nice, Dad. Sunny Angel knows how you feel.
I'm going to buy Sunny Angel a new Chicago Blitz jersey at RoyalRetros.com.
Sunny Angel forgives you.
Do you look at the way baseball is covered now and sort of the media landscape? And when you think about, you just mentioned guys like Phil Pepe and then, whoever, Bill Madden, and even like guys like Lupica, like old school Dave Anderson, the guys who populated the press boxes back in the day. Do you at all mourn for a certain bygone era that's probably not returning in sports coverage?
Yeah, but that makes me sound like an old fart.
You are an old fart. You're allowed to sound like
it. It's just, I mean, when I go shopping now for anything, I can't relate to whatever today's price is. To me, the price is what it was in the 90s or right. the 80s. How could you be charging me $9 for cough syrup? It's like that. That just goes with aging, and it'll happen with future generations as well. But I do miss the days when the newspapers held the power and the printed word and the holding and the feeling of the newspaper were so important. And today, I follow politics closely, and I never know which of the websites, ProPublica, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Am I supposed to be reading that every day, or Axiom? Or I just have kind of lost touch of the whole terrain. When it was all in the New York Times for me every morning, that was pretty sufficient. And now I know there's good journalism being done and all these other locations, and I can't check 15 locations every day. So I feel left behind.
Yeah. You worked a lot. You were at the Yankees when Sparky Lyle was with the Yankees. And I would say the first book of my kid that was like a nuclear bomb for me was The Bronx Zoo, which Sparky Lyle, quote unquote, wrote with Peter Golenbach. And it was a diary of the Yankee season. And I really came to sort of view Sparky Lyle probably as my first favorite player. And that book really felt like an insider's look into what life was like as a major league player. What was it like working with Sparky Lyle?
I just thought he was a joy to be with, that men and women would just love being in his company. He had just a great spirit of life, such a great attitude about if he blew a game, so what? Tomorrow's another day. Tomorrow's another game. And there was this drama about him, you know, on the baseball field where we created what's today called walk-up music, where he would come in the bullpen, Dotson, and I'd have the organist play Pomp and Circumstance. And that was a theme song. And I was the first PR guy to think of that and to do that. So it turned out after two seasons, he said, let's not do that anymore. That just adds to the pressure. I wasn't even aware he was feeling any pressure because he was like ice running in his veins. I'm glad you mentioned Sparky because, one, he remains a favorite of mine. And two, it's also a good example of what we were talking about earlier. I keep in touch with Sparky, except I'm really keeping in touch with his wife, Mary. She relays messages to him and brings back answers to me. Sparky doesn't sit down and text.
So you've written 25 books. I want to go through a few of your books and tell me sort of what comes to mind or what you think about, right? So first, as I've mentioned twice now, you wrote Thurman Munson, an autobiography. It came out in 1978. This is before Thurman Munson died tragically in a plane crash. It was by Thurman Munson, but really it was, I'm assuming, by Marty Appel talking to Thurman Munson. What was it like ghostwriting Thurman Munson's autobiography?
I remember at the end, he didn't think there was enough humor in it. And he wasn't exactly a funny guy. But I said, okay, I'll give me some stories. I'll work them in. And I did. But I never got a full appreciation from him that he was happy with the end product. Mostly I talked him into doing it because I said, if you don't, somebody else will do a biography of you. You just won an MVP award in New York City. You won't make any money off it. You'll hate everything that's in it. This is an insurance policy against that. So he went along with that, and that's how that book came to be. And by the way, I should say, it's just been reissued by Diversion Press.
Oh, wow.
That 1978 book has just this month been reissued for people who may not have the original book, with a foreword by Diana Munson and a new introduction by me. So I got that little plug in as well.
Yeah. So do we know for a fact Thurman Munson read the book?
Yeah, he read it because that's when he told me there wasn't enough humor in it. But what stays in my mind when you say what comes to mind, when he died that awful Thursday in August of 1979, and we went to Canton, Ohio the next day in his house, two things in the house. One, he had this big photograph framed on the wall of Dickie, Barra, Howard, and him, which he gave me such a hard time about being in the group photo.
And I just want to say, for people who may not know, that's Bill Dickey, Yogi Berra, Thurman Munson, Elson Howard, the sort of legendary Yankee catchers.
Yeah. But the other thing was, in her grief and in her tears and in wherever she was at the moment, Diana came to me in the house on that next day after he died and said, thank God you wrote that book with Thurman. He'll always have that.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Was that your first time dealing with an athlete's death?
Yeah, it's almost the first time I had dealing with anybody's death who was close to me. I had an uncle who died in 75, and that was it.
So when 31 years later, you write Munson, The Life and Death of a Yankee Captain, and you had this experience from three decades before of writing an autobiography, I'm sure you're a different writer 30 years later. Are you turning a lot to the old autobiography, or do you view it as a completely fresh research experience?
All fresh and new. I don't even think I consulted the original autobiography. It was an entirely different experience. It was my comfort zone, me alone at the keyboard writing a book. And with the Munson autobiography, of course, it involved taping, transcribing, dealing with him. It wasn't as comfortable and as pleasant. So, yeah, it was a very different experience.
Wait, so you wrote a book. I'm reading through your titles, and everyone has one of these, which I love. 1990, Working the Plate with Eric Gregg, the umpire Eric Gregg. I'm just going to ask, why is there a book, Working the Plate, by Eric Gregg with Marty Appel? How did that come to be?
My agent at the time, the late Bill Adler, was approached by an agent for Eric Gregg, thinking Eric could make for a good book. For those who don't remember him, a really overweight African-American umpire who was the only one in the league who was African-American, So as these four umpires traveled the National League together, he was always seeking his own neighborhoods, his own friends. They never included him in dinner plans. So it was a lonely life, and it told a lot about being African American in a very white environment. And Eric was just a very funny guy. So his stories, unlike Thurman's, we'd be sitting there laughing together at these great treasure stories. He wasn't the best umpire.
No, he was not.
But he did have a meltdown in an Atlanta Braves playoff game that, for those old enough to remember the game, he probably only called two or three pitches correctly the whole night. But the book was before that, so we didn't have to do a chapter on that particular game.
That's awesome. Was he really, I do remember two things. Number one, he was the only African-American umpire in baseball. Number two, he had a crazy strike zone. Was he an isolated presence? Were the other umpires, was it Stone era where the white umpires just didn't have a ton to do with him?
Yeah, that was his life. And he knew it, and he was good-natured about it. He was good-natured about everything. His first time getting on an airplane to go to umpire training school in Florida, he got on and sat in a first-class seat, and he thought first class meant first come, first serve.
That's awesome.
They had to remove him from the first class and send him back where he belonged. A Rosa Parks story.
That's fantastic. I don't know if you would agree. Your sort of your opus would be the book you wrote, Pinstripe Empire, the New York Yankees from before Babe Ruth to after the boss, which is this really thick, lovely, great, really history of the New York Yankees in many ways. And I could never write a book like that. I would not have the patience. I don't think I have the skill. I don't have the organizational ability. It was a great book. I feel like that book would drive me crazy. Did it drive you crazy?
No, because I made a conscious decision to write it chronologically. So I was quite comfortably moving from year to year to year. Jane Levy, who's a great writer, jumps back and forth all over her books. Mine, I stayed true to the chronology of the team. What inspired me for this was 1943, great sports writer named Frank Graham wrote a history of the Yankees up through 1943. And that was updated and revised into the early 50s. But nobody had written a purely narrative history of the Yankees since Graham in 43. And here it was like 2012. And I'm saying, this needs to be done. I mean, so much has happened since. So that was my goal. That was how we sold it to a publisher. And I'm very proud of that today. That is my opus. The fact that the Yankees deserved to be chronicled in a serious history. And I wrote it with some spirit and lightheartedness along the way where I could. But I remember, and as a writer, you would appreciate this, before I started, I made a list of every Yankee player whose name needed to be in a book about the history of the Yankees. And I made a list of every event that needed to be in a book about the history of the Yankees. So as I was writing, I was crossing it off, knowing that's all there, that's accomplished. And then I filled it in with other players and other moments and other events. But I knew if it came out and somebody said, you never mentioned how they came back from 3-1 down to beat the Braves in the 58 World Series, I would have said, I blew that one. But I didn't blow any of them. I had them all.
Yeah, that's really good. Well, I got to say, you didn't have the big trade when the trade that broke my heart, which was the Yankees sending Ken Griffey Sr. to Atlanta for Claudel Washington and Paul Zuvella. You missed that one in the book.
Okay, well, I'll get another chance, I hope.
I was thinking your 26th book can be about the big Griffey Claudel Washington trade. So I'm required on this podcast to ask this question. And I ask everyone, what's your best confrontation story from your career?
Well, it's kind of a light one, but I think it'll appeal to the audience.
Okay.
In 1973, we made a big trade. We traded Stan Bonson, one of our starting pitchers, to the White Sox for a guy named Rich McKinney, who had been a second baseman, but we were going to play him at third to succeed Celerino Sanchez.
Okay.
He was our big winter buildup. Rich McKinney has joined the Yankees. He's going to be a regular third baseman. And he batted 412 as a pinch hitter last year. We had all this background information. So in the winter, we used to do a promotional caravan to the outlying areas of New York City and maybe generate some early ticket sales. So we would charter a bus. We'd get on the bus, a barrel of beer on the bus. And I went to sit in the back with Rich McKinney because I wanted to get to know him. He was going to be one of our key guys. So I sit next to Rich McKinney and we're making some small talk and I'm telling him what my job is and what I do. And then he says to me, "Where can I buy some shit in this town?" And I'm like, "Huh?" And he goes, "Weed. Where do I buy weed in New York?" And I'm like, "Well, he's misread me."
Right. And
this is an awful moment because I don't know the answer, but I now know about Rich McKinney.
That's awesome.
He didn't make it till June with the Yankees. I can't say why, but talk about being in a tough situation on the first day you're meeting a guy.
Wait, I just want to say this is amazing. I did a quick Rich McKinney search here, and I found the article from the day after the trade in the New York Daily News. Dick Young's lead. Today, on a day that superstar Richie Allen was traded, the Yankees obtained pinch hitter Bernie Allen, and that's how a dynasty crumbles. The Yankees also obtained Richie McKinney, a potential third baseman, for righty Stan Bassin, but it was the Dodgers who did the double barrel blasting in baseball's blooming fish market, unloading Rich Allen to the White Sox and picking up Frank Robinson from Baltimore. The Mets did zilch, zero, nothing. That's amazing. That's amazing. That is a great, crazy Dick Young. Wait, I didn't expect to get here. Dick Young is I was not around for the Dick Young years, but people just seemed absolutely terrified by Dick Young. Absolutely terrified by Dick Young. You were a media guy when Dick Young was in his reign of terror in newspapers. Was Dick Young as scary as it sounds?
He intimidated me, but I had a professional relationship with him. I would never say we became friends. I could sit with him in the press room, but I always was cautious in what I said to him. And he always took my phone calls because there were times I had some Yankee news and that was his beat. He had to take the call. And he would always hear me out. He was very professional. So we had a working relationship, but it never went beyond that because, frankly, he scared the hell out of me.
Were there a lot of writers who scared the hell out of you?
Nobody else, no.
Wow, interesting. It's so funny. I was a baseball writer at Sports Illustrated for a few years, and Lupico was the main guy in town. And Lupico was probably the last big New York City columnist where, like, people literally would buy a newspaper to read a columnist. And I found Lupica's swagger super obnoxious and annoying, just being honest. I found it super obnoxious and annoying as an outside-looking-in magazine guy. Do you feel like guys like Young, like Lupica, in New York during a time period sort of needed that swagger?
I'm not sure, but the answer certainly is maybe. And part of it was a lot went on in the popular sports nightclubs of the time. Mike Minucci, the last part of Toot Shore's reign. So if you're going there looking for stories, looking to strike up conversations, I think you need a certain bit of swagger to carry you in.
I don't have it. Let me ask you a final thing. You say this is probably your last book. You've written 25 books. You view like this is your last. You spent your entire adult life in baseball in one way or another. Do you look back fulfilled? Do you look back and say this was a great way to spend existence? Like, of all the things I could have done, this was a very fruitful way? Or do you look back and think, man, I should have been a dentist?
Absolutely. I look back as having done the right thing. And I knew it was the right thing from elementary school. Saving baseball cards and being so interested in it, the backs of the baseball cards. And it was my world. And in my junior high school yearbook, next to my picture, it said, "Mel Allen, step aside." So I was always on this path.
That's so great. Someone wrote in my yearbook, "I remember going to high school with you when you're calling games for the Yankees." And I feel like, all right, I didn't call games for the Yankees, but I came close enough. You know, I entered this field and we've had these long careers in this field. There are times I look back and I think, like, you know, my college roommates, one guy, they're both lovely, but like one guy has worked for a bank for the last 40 years, 30 years. Another guy's been a lot. And like you guys like us, like we sort of followed our dreams and did something we really wanted to do. And it sort of pays off, doesn't it?
Don't tell anyone.
I know. Don't. It's our secret, Marty. We won't tell anyone. Yeah. Well, Marty, listen, I'm a huge admirer. I mean, I really am. Like, you've always been just a pro's pro and a lovely guy and a great ambassador for the game and obviously for the Yankees. The book, Pinstripes by the Tail, is awesome, nostalgic as anything. If it's your last book, which I hope it's not, it's a great way to go out. And really, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it.
A pleasure talking to you. I admire you just as you've described for me. And the body of your work is incredible, and you still have a long way to go.
Let's hope.
I want to thank today's guest, Marty Appel, for joining me on Two Riders Singing Yang. You can follow Marty on Twitter at Marty Appel NYY and buy Pinstripes by the Tail, Half a Century in and Around Yankees Baseball, wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd really appreciate it. Music is by the sizzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep riding.